Getting a job off the farm sometimes means you've got to drive about 6, maybe 10 miles. Not for Lee Tesdahl. He drives almost 200 miles between the home Century Farm in central Iowa to his job as an English professor in Minnesota. Today on the M2M podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television, I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening. We talk with Lee Tesdahl about what he does on the home place and how he works with his renter. We're going to get into the discussion of cover crops, his time on the PBS NewsHour, Practical Farmers of Iowa, and several other projects that go when it comes to cover crops and what's being done. There's an interesting point where you will hear about water that comes onto his property that he runs through a bioreactor and then sends it down the line. Those study results will be coming later on in this discussion. We enjoy as we chat with Lee Tesdahl on this installment of the M2M podcast. What's more fun for you, Lee? Teaching English or farming?
That's a good question. They actually fit pretty well together.
Okay, so how is that?
Yeah.
That they do?
So, at first blush, maybe it looks like they don't really fit that well together, but I teach courses in technical communication. So it's not Shakespeare, it's not grammar. We're not writing poetry in my classes. We're writing instructions, we're writing technical reports, we're writing documentation of various kinds. And so gathering data and analyzing it and displaying it in the visual form or textual form fits really well. And so the conservation work I do on my farm really helps me to prepare interesting assignments and things for my students. So it's really a pretty good fit.
And you teach in Minnesota?
I do.
And farm in Iowa? And what's the door-to-door distance there?
Right. Good question. Well, it depends a little bit on which road I take. But so 192 miles one way. I typically spend the work week up there, come home Thursday night if I can. Next week's finals week, so it'll be a longer week. But I get to see a lot of Iowa countryside, and I enjoy that, especially since I've started driving an electric car. I want to get up onto 169 through Blue Earth, Minnesota, where there's a fast charging station. And so I've really enjoyed driving Highway 17, 169, watching the crops and all the work that's going on in the country.
Do you teach both fall and winter semester? Do you do summer classes?
Right. So, yeah, we have two 16-week semesters, fall and spring, and about a month off in between. And then summer is optional at Minnesota State, Mankato, and I can do that from home online. So that works out pretty well.
Okay. Yeah. So you're making drives when the – in the fall, we'll start it as a school year when the crop is coming out.
Right.
Traditionally, this year it's going to be after finals for some
different
people on that route.
Yeah.
And then you get to see the crop go in towards the end of your semester. But otherwise, it's a lot of winter scenes. So I would imagine those extremes, that fall semester drive has always got to be wonderful.
Yeah, it is interesting. So that last week in August, maybe not a lot going on yet. Might be some early soybeans going out, possibly, maybe a little baling hay. There's not a lot of hay fields along the way. There's a few. I always look for cover crop also because I'm a cover cropper on my farm, and I like to see who's doing what. There's not a lot, unfortunately, in my opinion.
Or not enough.
Not enough, yeah. So then in getting into September, I start watching the harvest And I watch carefully for tillage because I preferred to leave the stubble, as we say, and not see so much tillage. So I always watch for that.
When you make that drive, do you ever get to a point where you write things down, or is it all mental snapshots?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, several weeks ago, I was actually inventorying fall tillage. And so I had a little notebook, and I had two columns and two or three rows across, and I had little check marks as I was driving. soybeans, corn, and if there was tillage going on or not. And but typically it's just snapshots, mental snapshots. Once in a while, I'll stop and take a picture.
Okay.
I did that last week.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask. So if you see something that you're very curious about or you want to ask somebody what they're doing because it looks a little different, do you ever get out and go knock on the door and say, hey, I'm just a guy that's driving. What are you doing there?
I haven't been quite that bold yet.
So. Do you think there – have you come to a point where you think you want to?
Yeah, I'd like to try that sometime. I might do that. I don't tractor and combine operators are busy people too, and they're probably, like marketing their grain while they're combining or whatever, right. and doing a lot of stuff. And so I hate to bother people too. Another thing about farm equipment these days, as you know, is farm equipment is big, and it takes about 5 minutes to climb up the ladder or climb out of the ladder.
Right.
And as I know from practical experience with my neighbors. And so you got to really want to disturb them, if you're going to do that.
That's right. That's right. And they really are going, who is this guy? This electric car.
Right.
Hippie professor stopping me when they find these things out.
That's
so,
right.
So, Lee, when did you start teaching at Mankato there?
So I started fall of 2002.
Was there a specific reason that you started?
Yeah, so my life took a pretty big turn in end of 2000. My wife passed away, and my kids were finishing up high school. One was just starting Iowa State, and one was a junior in high school in North Polk. And I was working in industry at that time. I got laid off in September 01 and had some part-time work. Then I got hired as a tech writer in Ames. And then I saw the ad for this job probably February 02, applied, and they liked me and got set up to start in August. Interesting fact, our current president, Richard Davenport, is also a Cyclone, and he and I started the same month, I think.
Oh, okay.
He might have started a month earlier. But so he and I are both 18 years now at Minnesota State Mankato. Two cyclones
in a world of they're not the Vikings. They're the that's where the Vikings train is in Mankato.
They did for 50 years. Unfortunately,
and,
they left.
And now they do it out of their own venue, right? That's right.
They built a new place.
Right.
Yep.
But it was. Have you run into Hayden Fox up there? Has he retired from the Coach TV show?
Hayden who? I've heard of Hayden Fry, but that's the wrong side of the state.
Right. No, I always think of Minnesota State Mankato. That was where they were the screaming Eagles during the TV show. Right.
The coach was it called Coach?
Coach. Yeah. Yeah.
Not a big TV watcher, but I have heard that Coach was. Basically modeled after it.
And I think last year the winter hit so early and the Minnesota State football team was supposed to play. They had won their first round game and they were having a second round game. And then I don't know if it was like 2 feet of snow came through and it was just an absolute winter wonderland around the stadium last year.
And here's the irony. I think our first round, I think we played a Texas team. And they didn't know how to play in the cold weather. Second round, I think, was another Texas team, Southern team somewhere, and they beat us. So, but now we're undefeated again this year. By the way, there was a local guy from Ballard High School, one of our best ever players, Chris Shout. And he graduated several years ago, but he was at Ballard High School and became one of our best players.
Okay.
But, yeah, we're undefeated again this year, and we'll see what happens Saturday. So.
During the whole time frame from when you started 02 to now and even before 02, has farming been a common thread for you? I mean, you said you were working in a factory. What was your involvement in the farm in the early 2000s and late 90s?
Yeah, so I was always interested in agriculture. I was a 4-H'er in Pennsylvania. My dad taught at Temple University for some years, and we lived in eastern Pennsylvania. My roots have always been Iowa roots. Then I ended up high school at Scattergood Friends School, West Branch, Iowa, which you've probably heard of, where we had a school farm. And, boy, when I was 15, there's nothing I wanted to do more than be a farmer because I had all these buddies from O'Brien County, and they were all farm kids, and the Wilson brothers and Joe Sims and so on. And I really got interested in production agriculture. So we were milking cows, raising pigs, and doing some field work and so on. And then I got to know more about my dad's family legacy here in northern Polk County and learned that we had still had farm ground. And one thing led to another.
One thing led to another. So when did you end up on the farm?
We moved out there in 82.
Okay.
I actually live in the house that was my great uncle's farmhouse, just half a mile from the 80. That's a Century Farm that I own now.
So what year did it become a Century Farm or close
84.
To? Okay, so you were right there for the ceremony then when it
right.
happened.
My wife and boys and I went down to the state fair, and who was the head of the Iowa Farm Bureau in 1984? It's a well-known name. Which I can't remember. It was sweltering hot. We were sitting under that tent at Iowa State Fair. And, you know, Tisdell starts with a T.
It took a while. Long time.
But, yeah, we got, I think it was 85, 86, we got the plaque. Yeah.
And I hate to tell you that they've moved that ceremony indoors to an air-conditioned building, but maybe it's because of all the sweltering that happened in
yeah.
the 80s.
Well, actually, I got the Environmental Leader Award this year, and you're right. It was inside. I think it looked like it used to be a cattle arena or something.
It still is.
Okay.
It's the Penningroth Media Center inside
exactly.
the beef building there.
Exactly.
And, yeah, they have my uncle had gotten that a few years ago. So, yeah, I've been to that ceremony. And it's a show ring. In fact, one of our past episodes, we did a series this year, the Start Smart Farming, the Coalition to Support Iowa's Farmers had done. We took the arena one Thursday morning and did five or six episodes, or did a couple of hours, five or six different speakers, and we've since mm-hmm. put that on if you want to go back a couple of episodes. And for starting farmers can listen to that. So when you get that Century Farm Award, it's a tough time in agriculture. And there were some farms that they were close to that century mark and they didn't make it into the next generation.
Right.
There's farms that haven't made it. How is it that yours has been able to stay in the farm? Obviously, it's not been enough to support you on that home
right.
place. You've had to take other employment.
Right.
Over the years, and a lot of people have had to do that.
Right.
How has agriculture changed from when you started living there in the early 80s to now?
Yeah, well, those were tough times. I remember we paid 13% interest on the loan that to buy that the farm place, the house from a neighbor. It had been my great uncle's, as I mentioned, and then a neighbor had bought it, and things had changed there, and then we bought it back. So 13% interest, and I know there were higher interest rates than that in farm country. But, yeah, so those were tough times, and we're in tough times again now. But as an owner and not an operator, of course, we're protected to a certain extent. And, you know, I'm cash rent now. I will say that I do speak with my operator, and we're on good terms, and we try to keep the rent fair. So the rent doesn't have to stay at the county average, I'll put it that way.
Who is your operator?
Mike Helland from Huxley. He's just a mile from my house.
How'd you find him?
Well, actually, our father's, his dad, Clark, first approached my dad, and we were actually using Farmers National as a farm manager at that time. And then they agreed on switching over to the Helens, and so we've been with them ever since. Really like working with them. They like no-till, and they're willing to do cover crops and all these other things that we're trying to do. They put up with me. So
well, I was going to say. So whose idea was it first to start in that cover crop?
We talked about together pretty much. The no-till was their idea. And I'll tell you how that happened. Mike always tells the story when we have a field day. He says, well, we had an Alice Chalmers 8550, which is the big articulated four-wheel drive Alice Chalmers. And it was time to trade equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, instead of getting a newer, bigger, or another expensive four-wheel drive, which is how they rip their corn stalks in the fall, because that's, as you know, on the farm, that's the task that needs the most horsepower. they decide just to go no-till and stop ripping their corn stalks, which 25 years ago was a little...
Pretty radical at radical. That point. Yeah. Absolutely.
But, and then he always finishes up that story by saying, and that was our best beans that year. So, you know, it's a great story, and I'm sure he's right. But because of 75% of their ground today is rented, of course, they have to do what the landowner wants. So if the landowner wants the corn stalks chisel plowed, they chisel plow. But we've been no-till ever since.
Where did that idea come from at that point?
Well, it was, like I said, it started pretty much with them and their equipment decision. And
it was so basically purely based on equipment. There wasn't any other, you know, there's this practice out there. The two didn't just come together. You're saying it was pretty much solely equipment and it was an aha.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, you save some diesel fuel in the fall. You save the wear and tear on equipment. You don't need the big tractor. Save some on labor and so on. Now, when it comes to cover crops, that was pretty much Mike and I together about 8 years ago. We thought we'd try it, and we like it. So we're going to continue doing that.
So where did you get that idea for the cover crop?
Well, I've belonged to Practical Farmers of Iowa for some years, and I'd heard a little bit about the concept. Didn't know much about it 8 years ago. But at the conference, the PFI conferences and so on, started to hear about it, and it made all kinds of sense, and it still does for me, because we're reducing our erosion. We're already fairly low on that because of the no-till, and we have some terraces and so on. And then the whole idea of sequestering excess nutrient, the N and the P particularly, made a lot of sense, and then trying to increase organic matter. Soil health, earthworm counts, that kind of thing. So to me, it all makes a lot of sense.
What's the main cover crop that you put in? Are you a radish guy?
Yeah, so I think we tried just radishes that first year, and they didn't work out real well. We got a little bit. But cereal rye is my favorite, and I think it is in Iowa in general. I really like cereal rye because you get some growth in the fall, then it goes dormant, and then you get that nice spring growth because it doesn't winter kill. It'll even germinate down about 34 degrees Fahrenheit, which is amazing. And then, you know, you get that beautiful green in March into April and really keep the ground covered. That's great.
What do you do with it at the end?
Well, typically, we spray it to kill it. With soybeans are pretty forgiving, so you can plant green soybeans, and you don't actually even have to kill it before you plant. You can do it right after planting. With corn, is a little pickier, so typically, rule of thumb, try to kill it 3 weeks before planting. There are some people, organic people, that are trying to roll it or crimp it,
yeah,
and keep that vegetative mat as a kind of a mulch to keep weeds down, and then plant into that. We haven't tried that, it's soybeans, and particularly soybeans, they just don't care that much. One year we did bale 10 acres of it, and we got it was pretty big, and my ewes did eat some of it. I think we let it go a little too long. We should have baled it a little younger.
So it was like
younger.
Bitter for them or something?
Well, it had already seeded out.
Oh.
And they didn't like those burrs in the, you know, in the grain. So, but that is another concept. And the cattle guys are really getting into this because they like to graze it over the winter. The problem there, of course, is a lot of people don't have good fence anymore.
Sure.
There is a concept out there called invisible fence, similar to what we have for dogs, that is, I think, some livestock people might start looking at. You put a collar on the animal and set out GPS coordinates of some kind. Don't know a lot about it yet, but want to look into it.
Well, that's a thing if it pencils out.
Right.
And that's a thing against cover crops is for some people it doesn't right. pencil out.
Right.
How do you have a conversation with someone who says, gosh, Lee, you know, it's just I can't afford to do it. It right. just doesn't make financial sense for
me. Well, that's a great question. And that's where I start talking about landlords, because I think landlords, the landowners, really have to be in the conversation when it comes to conservation. A lot of landlords probably don't know that much about cover crops. They don't care that much. Just care more about the rent check. But some do. Take, for example, out at White Rock Conservancy. Is that what it's called? The Garst family?
I was just going to say, I can't remember. I know where it is out there at, between Carroll and Glidden and Coon Rapids in that area.
They have a policy. This is my understanding. I don't speak for them. They have a policy where with their renters, they will pay 100% of the cost of cover crop, and then it's on a sliding scale, you know, over 5 or 10 years, which is a great idea. Mike and I do 50-50. So, you know, I think the landlords need to step up and pay for all of it, pay for half of it. What I do is I apply for cost share. So right now we're in a 5-year contract with RCPP, which is an EQIP program. And that picks up almost all the expense for us. Now, I will say that over 7 years, my cost average is $37 an acre. So you're right. There's money involved. But if you apply for cost share, you should come out okay.
So even if you get half that cut, let's just be generous on it, mm-hmm. or conservative, I guess, on the guess. How do you financially justify going to the bank – because everybody does, mm-hmm. on how what I'm doing makes sense environmentally. Because you can't really say, well, my water's cleaner. Well, but that doesn't – that doesn't.
It's not in the balance sheet.
It's not in the balance sheet, and the bank doesn't take a check for, oh, you – congratulations, Lee. Here's a check for being a good guy.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way.
No, you're absolutely right, and we don't put everything in the balance sheet that should be in there. So Tom Bowman – you've heard of Tom Bowman. Yeah. He used to be at Agron. I think he sold his company to Land O'Lakes. I think it's in part of the Sustain program now. But he had some pretty cool algorithms where he could tell you – according to the slope on your land and your farming practices, you know, you're losing, let's say, 15 cents or 20 cents an acre per year with soil erosion, because you're not only losing topsoil, you're losing the fertilizer that was in, you know, and so on. So there is a way to put it in your balance sheet. More of us should do that. But you're right. When you go to the banker, they don't care that much. So...
and you might find a banker 1 year that's sympathetic to it, and the next year not.
Right, right.
It just depends.
Right. So, but with the cattle people, I think they can pencil it out. So that's one thing. So the if you got decent fence and you have cattle, there's a guy at Lakeview. His name isn't coming to me right now, but he's a big proponent, Mark somebody, of grazing. He makes it work financially. In my case. No, but I'm also willing to negotiate on rent to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I might be unusual. I don't know. Because I want to see the operator making some money, if at all possible.
What if Mike, right? That's your renter.
Mm-hmm.
What if Mike would have said, no, I'm not going to do that.
Not going to do that.
I don't want to do cover crop. Oh, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
I just am not.
Yeah.
I guess I shouldn't. Now I'm not making you call out Mike.
Right.
But let's put you in the place of another landowner.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Because I know some renters who are like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to see all those weeds out there in March. that's
a point I'll get to in a minute.
In my book, it's beautiful green, and some people, how come my farm isn't looking black like the next guy? Yeah. So. What I would do in that case is I would probably, if there had a lease agreement, I'd put it in the lease and just say, we're going to do cover crops, and I would pay for it. I mean, I could understand if an operator just doesn't want to mess with it. But I would say right up front, okay, John or Brad or whoever it was, I would say, okay, any extra cost associated with the cover crop, you know, I'll pick it up, you know, whether it's extra herbicide to kill it or a different planter because you need more, as you probably know, you need a little more hydraulic down pressure to plant through all that stuff, things like that. Maybe plant a different number, corn number. I don't know if the corn breeders are coming out with cover crop friendly mm-hmm. numbers. I don't know about that. They might be. But it's so important, I think, to make it work that I would do that.
And you may have to move on and find somebody else that's willing to do it.
Yeah, I would hate to do it. Yeah.
If you had a good working relationship.
My attitude, well, so here's the thing. So when I win the lottery, I'm going to buy a couple more farms. And he says with...
You sure you don't have a cattle gene in you? You want to feed that money until it's gone.
Right. And I've thought this over, actually. I'm not going to win the lottery, but what I would prefer to do is have a different operator on each farm and introduce them to, cover crop, no-till.
And that, I would imagine, that might be some, I think, as Practical Farmers of Iowa, is that something they have talked about, that type of program, introducing new farmers into it? There is a group, and maybe it's not PFI, but I've heard that concept of, I am the operator, I'm rotating through somebody to help them understand how... Right. This practice
we
would work.
We do have a beginning farmer program at PFI, and I'm sure there would be an effort to introduce new farmers to innovative practices. I'm not sure that there's one specifically for getting new farmers into particular practices like no-till or cover crop. There might be.
We still get comments almost any time we post an environmental story on our Facebook page or Twitter page, and I'll get a comment every once in a while about, until you pay me to do this, farmers aren't going to do it.
All right.
Are we going to get to that point?
Yeah, good question. I mean, you really – back to the balance sheet.
Or should we get to that point?
Yeah. Well, back to the balance sheet. I mean, you have to look at the balance sheet, and if you're not chisel plowing your corn stalks in the fall, you're saving some money there. I think it's around $9 an acre probably it cost you.
And that's on the cost.
On the cost side.
But then there's some soil types that'll tell you that, well, I'm losing 2 to 3 bushel an acre for not getting that soil tilled.
Right. And PFI's research has shown, they just published 10-year research on, I think, 4 or 5 different farms across Iowa, a number of years with strips and corn and soybeans. There's not a lot of yield difference. Cover croppers can't really claim a big yield bump. There was a little bit with soybeans, I think, in those studies. With corn, it doesn't care that much. Of course, back to the management. The management needs to be on. You need to know how to manage your fields. But, we pretty much have put that one to rest, I think, it's not killing yields. We're, just to give you numbers from my farm, so we did a 10-year average on the corn. We're 163. Polk County 10-year average is 172, so we're within 10 bushel there. I will say 2 years ago, we were the best ever. It was 214, so that average has come up a little bit. Soybeans, we're at 44.69. County average is 51.4. So, we're within range. It's not. Mike's not losing a lot of grain.
Right. And who knows what soil health he'll have in 20, 30 years.
Well,
that hasn't washed away.
That's what I think. My sons and I talk about that. And I've got 5 grandkids, and we were hoping that, this long range, these practices today are providing long range benefits that aren't, as you pointed out, are not in the balance sheet.
Right. And that's, we live in a dollars and cents world. Yep. And that's an argument of it. If the business doesn't make sense, I just can't I can't do it is one argument. Another is I don't know how to do it. So if you've got somebody who's maybe not curious, heard a little about it, but there's no neighbors around them to ask, who should they contact?
Yeah. Well, I would suggest go to the Practical Farms of Iowa website and look at the research studies. Come to the annual conference, attend field days. I've had a number of field days over the years, and other neighbors have had in central Iowa. Just go around and see what people are doing and drive through the countryside. And if you see a cover crop field, stop and kind of look it over. And the information is out there. And I think quite available, go online and dig around. As I pointed out, I commute up to Mankato, southern Minnesota, every week. And in southern Minnesota, they do even more tillage than we do. They even till their soybean stubble pretty much 100%. Down here, typically what you see is my neighbors will just till the end rows.
Where there's a little more compaction.
But, of course, they leave it in the soil as they drive around the other side. But anyway, so it's got a black ring all around it, But anyway, that's
looks okay. Better on Google Earth. Though.
There you go. Yeah. Got a nice circle or square or rectangle. Right. But they do even more tillage up there. And I think that's a harder nut to crack. I actually had lunch yesterday in Mankato with Miles Elson, who's the new NRCS guy in Mankato, Blue Earth County. They moved him from southern Minnesota over to Blue Earth County. And he knows a lot about conservation, so I'm hopeful that we can do some more, get some more winter meetings going on, getting him in to speak to classes and things in the area as well.
So. Well, and okay, that's a good point. I did kind of want to go there a little bit. I was going to ask you about your drive. I think you said earlier you don't really notice many cover crop fields between right. and your 196 miles.
Right.
So how do you break into an area? I mean, you talk about a new person, new blood, new energy. They might have a new approach. And does it take just one or two big farmers or small farmers, someone trying to make a difference to get the neighbors, huh? But I like a good black field.
Right.
Looks nice. Aesthetically pleasing. It's aesthetically, that's the way we do it in this county.
Yeah.
Is everything gets plowed under in the fall or chiseled under in the fall.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it's going to be a very hard row to hoe?
Yeah.
Or not hoe, I guess, is what you want to happen.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to go there.
It's too easy.
Yeah. I think there are nodes of activity. In Iowa, anyway. So you take Mitchell Hora down in Washington County. He's buddies with Zach Johnson. They do the Fieldwork podcast, Minnesota Public Radio. According to him, Washington County is kind of a hotbed of cover crop. And I think it's a little hillier, and it makes more sense down there. Ray Gesser, southwest Iowa, mm-hmm. He and his son do, I think they farm about 6,000 acres, and they're mostly all rented, I think. But maybe 100% cover crop, I know, but pretty high number. So there are these nodes around. There are a few that I know of in Minnesota, but not many. It's tough. I've had coffee a couple times this semester with Doug Adams in Humboldt County. He works for the NRCS in Humboldt and farms also in Humboldt County. And, he has field days and he promotes cover crops. He's very active on Twitter. You probably see him a lot. It's called Farmer Doug on Twitter. And so there are these people out there that are very active, and they show that yields don't suffer and they're saving money in the fall. And, it looks different, but, it's working.
Yeah. It is.
And we're saving some topsoil. We're doing good things for the future. So.
This year was a challenging year for weather-wise, just like it was in the spring and the fall. Were you able to get into your field? Was Mike able to get into the field earlier, or did he have to wait longer because of the cover crop stubble that was there or the cover crop that had started to grow here?
Right. Good question. So we seeded – we had a big field day on August 21st, and we were – Hagee and Montag had teamed up to bring out a high boy cedar, Hagee mm-hmm. cedar, and they were going to actually demo that on the day. But it was just a little damp, and I didn't want to have ruts out there in Mike's corn. So we actually seeded the next day, August 22nd. And so we had some growth by harvest time, and you're right. Harvest was tough this fall. It was wet, and so Charles came over and got maybe a third harvested one Sunday, and then it sat for another 2 weeks, and he came back and got the rest of the corn. There's no problem harvesting corn with maybe the rise 6, 8, 10 inches tall, there can be a problem, and actually it's a good point that you brought up, there can be a problem with soybeans. So if you have a late season, can't get in to harvest the soybeans, and the cereal rye is having all kinds of fun growing, and so you can get a little bit of green stuff running through the combine as you're harvesting your soybeans. I've not heard that that's a big problem. Are you getting docked or anything for your beans? I don't know for sure. But that is one thing to think about. That, you know, if you seeded in August and you're cutting your beans in early November because it's been wet all fall, that rye might be pretty tall
right.
in those beans.
Right.
And because maybe the beans got snowed on twice, you know, and they're kind of
this year that's possible
going
probably
down
three times
and, so that's one thing to think about. You have to adapt to that, and I haven't heard a lot of information about how people deal with it, but I think that the green stuff just runs through the combine, goes out the back mostly, and doesn't really create a problem with the beans themselves.
But it is something. Have you flown the cover crop on before,
we
too?
We have. Yeah, we've used a plane 3 or 4 years. It's in my area, it's $13 an acre for the plane. One of the drawbacks with aerial seeding is wind. So you can end up giving your neighbor a little gift.
Yeah.
So we have kind of a running joke about that with Kurt and Wayne. I have a little running jokes about that little green strip that's, you know.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And we trade jokes about it. But, you know, good fences make good neighbors. And in this case, you want to, you know, be nice with your neighbors when that happens. It is nice because you can look at the weather forecast and say, oh, it's going to rain tomorrow. I'm going to fly on my seed today. It's going to germinate right away. So that's an advantage. That's wonderful. You don't want the rye seed sitting there for 2 weeks on dry dirt, not germinating, which can happen.
Which can, yeah.
Which can happen with a Hagee or, you know. We like the plane, but we don't like the plane. Put it that way.
Have you done any post-harvest where you've drilled it on too?
We did a little bit last year. So we put it on with a plane last year, but I mentioned the wind. Well, that day, I think it was September 1st, there was an east wind, and you could tell there was an east wind when the rye started coming up, you know, because you went right down, but there wasn't any rye there. It was 20 feet to the west. So Mike went back in with an air seeder, which he's planted soybeans with, and so he planted cereal rye, 15-inch rows, and that worked great. So, you know, you can go, it's extra work, but yeah. You can go back in and hit the areas that
touch
the
up.
Missed.
Yeah. Touch up where you need to.
It's not ideal, but you can do it.
You don't spend as much time here during political season. Have you ever had a conversation with a candidate or a politician about, you know, on a national or a state level, some laws, rules, regulations might benefit? Have you ever ducked into any of that? Or written letters, use your English background?
Yeah, I've thought about that, and I've tried to get Cindy Axne out to the farm. I've tried to get Amy Klobuchar
representative,
out to the farm.
And then the senator from Minnesota,
right.
Yep.
And I've tried one or two other candidates. I've mentioned that, you know, come out for half an hour or an hour and show you around. We'll talk this stuff over. I am at 3 o'clock. I'm going to be in Grinnell and I'm going to ask some questions. They've got six candidates coming to the Iowa Farmers Union panel this afternoon.
Okay.
And so I intend to have some prepared questions there. But I think in Iowa we really need to fully fund the reduction strategy program. Nutrient reduction strategy. It's never really been fully funded. And I think that'd be a good place to start in Iowa. So,
all right.
Put some pressure on there. So.
Before I let you go, some people, they hear your voice. They may have seen your face and heard your voice on a PBS show before. You had a NewsHour crew
right.
come out this year. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, we didn't know quite what to expect. And so, you know, I thought they were going to come out for half an hour or something. And so Mike and I were pretty well tied up all day, 1st of July. But it was interesting. It was a hot day, and they had two cameras, and they kept making us redo stuff. And Mark Bittman was the interviewer, who I didn't know much about. And then my daughter-in-law said, "What? You had Mark Bittman on your part?" So then I knew he was important. But he's a food guy, basically. I guess he's written a lot of stuff on food recipes and where our food comes from and so on. So, yeah, they spent probably 6-8 hours with us at my place, at Mike's place. Got a lot of video, two cameras. And it was really interesting for us. I was a little bit leery about what neighbors and Iowans would think about the final product, as I didn't really. So I wrote email to Melanie Saltzman and Mark a day or two later, and I said, you know, it's really important to honor or to respect the farmers in this too. We know that we need to change practices, but the people raising the corn, soybeans, and pigs and chickens and cattle in Iowa are working hard and need to be respected for their work, even if we think, you know, we're the industrial farming and Iowa's going down the wrong path in some ways, but please respect the people. You know, I wanted that to be real clear. So I don't know if that affected the way they trimmed the film together. Yeah, but
so what
that's important to me.
What did they initially pitch to you was the story? Was it about sustainability or was it about more of the factory side of things?
Yeah, so I wasn't clear. So they emphasized prairie strips on my farm, and they emphasized the financial side, I guess you could say, of grain production on Mike's farm. They had already spoken to Matt Liebman at Iowa State University about small grains and perennial crops on the land and so on. And they, Sam Bennett, the young farmer at Galva, Iowa, they had been up there and filmed his field day and some cover crops and stuff. So they didn't want to redo everything on my farm, so we concentrated on prairie strips. So I didn't know how it was going to work out and what they were interested in. They filmed everything, you know, and then they ended up just with prairie strip and saturated buffer, actually. They honed in on that as well. Saturated buffer story is kind of interesting. So it's a tile that comes off my neighbor's farm. So we're not actually cleaning up my tile water, but because the creek is on my side, his tile dumps into the creek on my 80. And so we put saturated buffer in on my land with Equip money that helped us out a lot, cost share. And so we're cleaning up his tile water before it dumps into Formula Creek on my land. And then doing that for people downstream. We don't see any benefit from that, obviously, but we like to see that it works, that the technology works. Iowa Soybean Association, just to give a shout out to them, they have been instrumental in doing the water sampling and planning and stuff too, and the NRCS, so it's been great to work with them.
Have you noticed on a testing, you know, what was your parts per million before and after, and if what your efforts are
funny,
working?
Funny you should mention
that. To the
that.
Documents we go, Lee.
I just got the spreadsheet from Iowa Soybean Association.
Fantastic.
My buddy Corey is great. So the bioreactor is at, in 2019, the bioreactor, which is a wood chip bioreactor.
Yep.
So this is year 7 of operation, is denitrifying this year, this is 1 year data, sorry, 68% of the nitrate is being taken out. And the saturated buffer that I just described to 88% is taken, so it's quite a bit more effective. But that's only 1 year data. So lifetime, the bioreactor is at 58%. And the saturated buffer is at 92%. So they're both working. Technology works in these cases. And we like the results. We're not doing a lot of good. We're doing this much good.
But you're trying.
But we see that it works, and we see that we're doing a little bit of good.
And that's the type of thing that can get filtered up, I guess pun intended, to those that are making decisions about funding the right. initiative that you talked about right. earlier.
Nutrient production strategy. Yeah.
And other things that the lawmakers can see. Well, you know, if we can make some of that money available, maybe we can
right.
make a difference and stem off any potential lawsuits from one water district to another or a city to a county
right.
that did something that another town thinks is their problem and the
right.
source's problem. You know, I mean, that
right.
was a big discussion for a long
right.
time.
Right.
So
yeah, and I'm glad we had the discussion. I feel bad, of course, for the family of, as my neighbors called him, the Des Moines hippie, mm-hmm. who was running Des Moines Water Works because of his cancer and, you know, and his early death. But I think he started a really important discussion. I know I had neighbors that just really didn't like what he was doing. But, hey, we're talking about it some more than we would have been.
Yeah. Yeah, the late Bill Stowe died
Bill Stowe,
in 2019.
About a year ago?
Yeah, it was earlier this year, I think.
Right.
It was right there in January
yeah.
or something like
right.
that, if I remember.
Right.
So.
Right.
Well, Lee, I told you a few minutes, and here we are a few more minutes into it. So I guess I'll let anybody sum up, or is there anything you want to talk about that we didn't? Any questions you have for us or things that you want to talk about, set the record straight on?
Yeah, well, thanks for your time. And I am a faithful watcher of Market to Market, and now I'm going to be listening to your podcast as I commute across north central Iowa. And, you know, these newfangled automobiles, you can do all this stuff now with hands-free, right?
That's right. You just say, play that, play the M2M podcast. So hopefully we get you to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating just because you appeared on it. That's
right.
not mandatory, but sure, that's
right.
nice.
Hey, Google, open CastBox. and then it opens CastBox, and I can just listen to Market to Market. But I just want to emphasize that landowners and operators really need to be working together on conservation. And I like the idea of working in our watersheds. So.
Yeah. All right. Lee, thank you so much for the time. Appreciate having you in here today in between. And good luck on finals next week.
Thank you.
Clicking subscribe is the best way to stay in the loop on what we do here at the M2M podcast. Or if you have feedback for us, hit me up at paul.yeager@iptv.org. Send me an email or hit me up on Twitter @PaulYeager. Thanks for listening.